When Taryn Cornick's sister was killed, she was carrying a book. People don't usually take books when out on a run, but Beatrice must have planned to stop, perhaps at the Pale Lady, where she was often seen tucked in a corner reading, a pencil behind her ear. The book in the bag still strapped to Beatrice's body when Timothy Webber bundled her into the boot of his car was the blockbuster of that year, 2003. A novel about tantalizing epoch-spanning conspiracies. Beatrice enjoyed those books, perhaps because they were often set in libraries. The Cornick girls loved libraries. Most of all, the one at Prince's Gate, which belonged to their grandfather, James Northover. Beatrice was 17 and Taryn 13 when their grandfather died. The family had to give up the debt-encumbered house, though Grandma Ruth stayed on in the gatehouse while she continued at her vet's practice. It was Grandma Ruth whom Beatrice was visiting when Webber found her. Beatrice and Taryn's parents were separated. Basil Cornick was in New Zealand, playing the bluff fellow in a fantasy epic. Addie Cornick had been struggling with illness and was dispiriting company. Taryn would spend some of her holidays with her mother, then stay with friends. She never went near Prince's Gate, because she couldn't cope with the changes. A farm conglomerate had taken over the estate. The new owners left the last of the wetlands intact and the plantation forest with its kernel, a copse of ancient oaks. But the stone walls were dismantled to make long fields with nothing to impede the big harvesting machines, not walls or drainage ditches or the hawthorn hedges the foxes had followed. The library had already gone, broken up before the sale. James Northover's books passed into the hands of the owners of antiquarian bookshops, except a few long-coveted items that went to his collector friends, perhaps including the ancient scroll box, known as the Fire Starter, because it was said to have survived no fewer than 5 fires in famous libraries. So, the book bumping against Beatrice's shoulder blades as she took her last steps was one of those set in old museums and libraries. A book with a light in its long perspective, like the light of a grail. A book with scholarly heroes and hidden treasure. Beatrice was running in her baggy sweats and bouncing backpack. It was autumn, and there was a light mist. The road between St. Canog's Cross and the village of Prince's Gate Magna was thickly covered in fallen leaves, its surface amber but for 2 black streaks where the leaves had been chewed up and tossed aside by the tyres of passing cars. The road was quiet. Beatrice wasn't wearing headphones. She moved off onto the verge when she heard the car. The mist began to sparkle, and the reflectors on Beatrice's shoes flashed as the headlights caught them. Whenever a restless night summoned her sister, her grey sweats and swinging ponytail, Taryn never found herself on that road. She was always in the car. In the driver's seat. She was the murderer, Timothy Webber. Taryn thought this might have been because she had spent so much time wondering why Webber had done it. Wondering how anyone does a thing like that. The trial was held a year after Beatrice died. Taryn attended and became familiar with every detail of what happened, or at least what was known. Webber's car hadn't clipped Beatrice because she wasn't far enough off the road. The police photographs showed a curved tire track in the black mud. They showed how far he had swerved to catch her. There were no skid marks because he'd braked already, reducing speed not to pass safely, but to hit Beatrice hard enough, he hoped, to subdue her. His car cracked Beatrice's pelvis and a roadside oak, her skull. He stopped, got out, and scooped Beatrice up from where she lay in the lap of some tree roots. He put her in his boot. Webber's lawyers let him take the stand, perhaps hoping his fecklessness would convince the jury that his actions lacked malice. He told the kind of feeble story kids concoct when they're caught out. He said he put Ms. Cornick in his trunk to take her to hospital. But, the prosecution asked, wouldn't most people place an injured person in the back seat? Or not move her at all and wait to flag down the next car? Webber said he'd been too afraid to wait for someone to come along. It was a quiet road. He wasn't carrying a phone. It would probably have all gone better for him, he said, if he'd just driven off and had to face a charge of hit and run instead of this one. But I couldn't do that. He screwed up his mouth in an expression of apology. Why I put her in my trunk rather than my back seat must have been because she'd soiled herself and was a bit of a mess. The jury moaned in anger.